Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to continue with an analysis of the historical and functional relationship between journalism and the intelligence community. Specifically, in this case, we're going to be examining the relationship between the Central Intelligence Agency and the American journalistic community. Now, one should not make the mistake of equating the CIA with the U.S. intelligence community. It is obviously part of it. At the same time, it's only the CIA, that is, only receives about 15% of the intelligence community budget. One does not hear about the DIA, the NSA, ONI, OSI, the Army Security Agency, or various other intelligence agencies. One does hear about the CIA, but one should not make the mistake of equating the CIA with U.S. intelligence per se, although, again, obviously it is part of it. The CIA and the intelligence community are not coterminous. This article, however, examines the journalistic community in the CIA. It's an article entitled, appropriately, Journalism and the CIA, subtitled The Mighty Wurlitzer. It's by a very fine researcher named Daniel Brandt, last name B-R-A-N-D-T, and this article was published in the Namebase Newsline. Specifically, this is from the Namebase Newsline number 17, their issue of April through June of 1997. Namebase Newsline is edited by Steve Badrich, or Badrich, B-A-D-R-I-C-H. They can be reached at P.O. Box 680635, San Antonio, Texas, 78268. That's P.O. Box 680635, San Antonio, Texas, 78268. The telephone number is area code 210-509-3160. Once again, that's 210-509-3160, fax number 210-509-3161. And the email and website address are a little bit too small for me, for my middle-aged eyes here to handle. So that should be nonetheless relatively easy for people to find using a search function. In the first part of the discussion concerning this article, I read from the article and we examined the development of the historical relationship between the Central Intelligence Agency and the media. This was a relationship that had its genesis during the Second World War with the CIA's predecessor, the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, and the relationship then developed during the Cold War. Specifically, Deputy Director of Central Intelligence Frank Wisner had much to do with developing the CIA's media component, and he termed the CIA's media component, The Mighty Wurlitzer, hence the title or the subtitle of this particular article. After a discussion of various journalistic attempts, somewhat attenuated attempts, as it turned out, after discussing various journalistic attempts at disclosing the truth concerning the relationship between journalists and the CIA, the author Daniel Brandt writes as follows. The next article was by Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame. In a long piece in Rolling Stone, he came up with a figure of 400 American journalists over the past 25 years, that is to say, working with the CIA, beginning again. The next article was by Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame. In a long piece in Rolling Stone, he came up with a figure of 400 American journalists over the past 25 years, based primarily on interviews with church committee staffers. This figure includes stringers and freelancers who had an understanding that they were expected to help the CIA, as well as a small number of full-time CIA employees using journalism as a cover. It did not include foreigners, nor did it include numerous Americans who traded favors with the CIA and the normal give and take between a journalist and his sources. In addition to some of the names already mentioned above, Bernstein supplied details on Stuart and Joseph Alsop, Henry Luce, Barry Bingham Sr. of the Louisville Courier-Journal, Hal Hendricks of the Miami News, columnist C.L. Sulzberger, Richard Salant of CBS, and Philip Graham and John Hayes of the Washington Post. Bernstein concentrated more on the owners, executives, and editors of news organizations than on individual reporters. Let's not pick on some poor reporters, for God's sake, William Colby said at one point to the Church Committee's investigators. Let's go to the management. They were witting. Unquote. Bernstein noted that Colby had specific definitions for words such as contract employee, agent, asset, accredited correspondent, editorial employee, freelance, stringer, and even reporter. And through careful use of these words, the CIA, quote, managed to obscure the most elemental fact about the relationships detailed in its files, i.e., that there was recognition by all parties involved that the cooperating journalists were working for the CIA, whether or not they were paid or had signed employment contracts, unquote. The reaction to Bernstein's piece among mainstream media was to ignore it or to suggest that it was sloppy and exaggerated. Then, 2 months later, the New York Times published the results of their, quote, three-month inquiry by a team of Times reporters and researchers, unquote. This three-part series not only confirmed Bernstein, but it added a wealth of far-ranging details and contained twice as many names. Now, almost everyone pretended not to notice. The Times reported that over the last 20 years, the CIA owned or subsidized more than 50 newspapers, news services, radio stations, periodicals, and other communications facilities, most of them overseas. These were used for propaganda efforts or even as cover for operations. Another dozen foreign news organizations were infiltrated by paid CIA agents. At least 22 American news organizations had employed American journalists who were also working for the CIA, and nearly a dozen American publishing houses printed some of the more than 1,000 books that had been produced or subsidized by the CIA. When asked in a 1976 interview whether the CIA had ever told its media agents what to write, William Colby replied, quote, "Oh, sure, all the time," unquote. Since domestic propaganda was a violation of their charter, the CIA defined the predictable effects of their foreign publications as, quote, blowback, unquote, or, quote, domestic fallout, unquote, which they considered to be, quote, inevitable and consequently permissible, unquote. But former CIA employees told the Times that apart from this unintended blowback, again quoting, some CIA propaganda efforts, especially during the Vietnam War, had been carried out with a view toward their eventual impact in the United States. The Times series concluded that, at its peak, the CIA's network, quote, embraced more than 800 news and public information organizations and individuals, unquote. By the time the Times series appeared, Congress was looking for a way out of the issue. Obligingly, Stansfield Turner promised that the CIA would avoid journalists, quote, accredited by any U.S. news service, newspaper, periodical, radio, or television network, or station, unquote. There were at least three problems with this that most press coverage overlooked. Many stringers and freelancers are not accredited. It didn't cover any foreign-owned media, and as Gary Hart complained at the time, the new policy included a provision that allowed the CIA to unilaterally make exceptions whenever it wished. Within several years of this alleged policy, the new Reagan administration ignored it in favor of a shooting war in Central America, one component of which was an illegal, CIA-administered propaganda war at home. Edgar Chamorro, a Contra sympathizer in Miami with a background in public relations, was recruited by the CIA in late 1982. After 2 years of following the CIA's instructions regarding the manipulation of U.S. journalists and even members of Congress, Chamorro went public with his story. By now, Congress was clearly outmaneuvered, even though it alone held the purse strings that controlled funding for the war. The inability of Congress to address the CIA media problem in the 1970s meant that more powerful forces were at work. In fact, while Congress was wringing its left hand over illegal CIA activities, its right hand was helping the CIA overhaul its Wurlitzer. Ever since 1967, when the Katzenbach Committee was tasked by Lyndon Johnson to study the problem of the CIA's use of domestic organizations, the agenda at the highest levels had been to remove such activities from the CIA's payroll and continue them under a new umbrella. In the unclassified portion of their report, this committee recommended giving money openly through a, quote, public/private mechanism, unquote. The CIA's big mistake was not supplanting itself with private funds fast enough, unquote, observed Gloria Steinem, who had been part of the CIA's global network. By the way, Steinem, in touting her journalistic credentials, mentioned her background in the CIA in interviews with the New York Times and Washington Post, and said basically that the CIA was good journalistic training. And so her CIA background is a matter of public record. Continuing, the Asia Foundation was given a large, quote, severance payment, unquote, to tie them over while they looked for private funding, and the Congress for Cultural Freedom got over $4 million from the Ford Foundation. In 1971, Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe were spun off and funded separately by new legislation. While this hardly diminished the CIA's control of these radio stations, it did help public relations by facilitating, quote, deniability, unquote. Then, in 1983, Congress created the National Endowment for Democracy with funding to carry on many of the activities that the CIA once carried out covertly within its own budget. Bits and pieces of the old Wurlitzer were still evident everywhere. John Richardson Jr., the new chairman of NED, had been president and CEO of Radio Free Europe during the 1960s, and some of the NED's dozens of grants were issued to groups that solicited aid for the Contras. Quote, "It is not necessary to turn to the covert approach," unquote, commented Colby in regard to the NED program. Again, that's the National Endowment for Democracy. I've discussed that in, among other programs, RFA 36. It is sort of an overt covert operations vehicle and was instrumental in, among other things, the destabilization of the Soviet Union. Again, I refer interested listeners to RFA 36, available from Spitfire. Continuing. Quote, "It is not necessary to turn to the covert approach," unquote, commented Colby in regard to the NED program. Again, quoting, "Many of the programs which were conducted as covert operations can now be conducted quite openly and, consequentially, without controversy." As if to prove his point, Colby's wife was soon a member of NED's board of directors. Two major changes since the 1980s, the collapse of socialism and the centralization of domestic and transnational media, suggest that the CIA now has everything well in hand. But it is far too early to tell. The pressure to stay competitive in the global marketplace could provoke economic nationalism in countries where the CIA was once free to roam. France and Germany, for example, have recently expelled CIA agents. At the same time, the Soviet people are having second thoughts about all those benefits of U.S.-imposed capitalism. China remains aggressive and uncompromising. They may even tolerate less interference from us in their political process than we do from them. It's a different world, and it's unfamiliar. A blue-ribbon panel of the Council on Foreign Relations suggested last year that the CIA be freed from some policy constraints on covert operations, such as the use of journalists and clergy as cover. This is alarming. Unlike the typical corporate-funded think tank filled with pro-Pentagon pundits, the folks at CFR are either running the world or they know who does. For 70 years, they've rarely recommended anything that has not become policy. Furthermore, they've thoroughly co-opted the major media. There have also been official announcements that the CIA is mission creeping into economic intelligence and computer-age information warfare. This might reflect a bit of nostalgia for the job security and moral clarity of the Cold War, or it could be a premonition that the American century is over and the masses are expected to get uppity. Perhaps the First Amendment has always been something of a con, a matter of, quote, freedom, unquote, but only for those who own the presses or for those who lived in an earlier century before Cy War and public relations experts. Then again, stay tuned. The credibility gap is back. By the way, that refers to the gap between what the government was saying during the Vietnam War and what the public was inclined to believe. So that's the reference to credibility gap. Younger listeners may not remember that particular journalistic and ideological football. Beginning again, then again, stay tuned. The credibility gap is back. A recent poll shows that Americans are fed up with the mainstream news media. Quote, "very favorable," unquote, ratings for television network news fell from 30% in 1985 to just 15% this year, and for large national newspapers it dropped 12%. A majority now believe that news stories are often inaccurate. After factoring in the new global economics and recalculating the prospects for the middle class, all bets are off. The poor performance of Congress and the press on the issue of journalists and the CIA may mean that the next time around, the elites will lack even the credibility to stage another co-opting charade of, quote, oversight, unquote. That could prove beneficial, particularly if the next time threatens to be as inconsequential and diversionary as the last time. And by the way, I would note a couple of things. First of all, not only is the mainstream press deeply involved with the intelligence community, but in point of fact, the so-called alternative media, as well as the so-called progressive sector itself, is heavily infiltrated and profoundly influenced by the intelligence community. I would also note in this regard that in the 1990s, there has been something of a conspiracy industry that has grown up. I refer to it contemptuously as Conspiracy Incorporated, and they are not only infiltrated, they are controlled by the intelligence community. And one of the things that, and this, by the way, that is not to say that all or even most of the individuals in it are intelligence operatives. Rather, I think it is an amoral and essentially profit-driven milieu. And they simply do not care whether an individual has integrity. They do not care whether material is good or bad as long as it sells. They're quite comfortable with fascistic organizations such as the Liberty Lobby. And indeed, I think that the kindest thing one could say about Conspiracy Incorporated is that it is amoral and that, in fact, it is a an unwitting tool of the very interest it professes to be opposed to. So please note that as well. I think that one of the more grotesque ironies of the American political reality in 1997 is that even those, and this is not to say there are not some good researchers, there are, Daniel Brandt is an example of that, but there is a remarkably unprofessional, amoral, and to a certain extent proto-fascistic bent to research into political conspiracies in the 1990s. There are some good researchers. I personally loathe the term conspiracy theorist or conspiracy research. I refer to myself as an anti-fascist researcher. But you talk about anti-fascism to the average American in 1997, and they're going to say, well, I didn't know her personally, but I hear she was quite a gal. And it one will very quickly lose people. So do note that even though mainstream organizations are, as a matter of public record, profoundly influenced by and inextricably linked with the intelligence community, the CIA in particular, they are not alone in this regard. And many of the critics of the machinations of the intelligence community would do well to heal themselves before they hang their medical shingle on the wall. In a very informative sidebar to this particular article, Daniel Brandt discusses the Council on Foreign Relations. The CFR is a very important body. Its influence and ideological valence, so to speak, are frequently distorted by such institutions as the John Birch Society, which make the CFR out to be related to international communism, which it most assuredly is not. It is, in fact, one of the founts of ideological anti-communism in the United States in this century. It is also a profoundly influential and immensely powerful organization, and along with the closely related Trilateral Commission, they wield a tremendous influence. It is sad that in the rush by the so-called progressive forces, as well as by the mainstream media, to debunk conspiracy theory, that they have overlooked the CFR and the Trilateral Commission to a considerable extent. And as I said, I think it's sort of sad that those who do research these kinds of things pay no real attention to the obvious signs of infiltration and even fascistic control of their own media. Of their own milieu, I should say, watching organizations like the Liberty Lobby, people with open affiliations with Nazi organizations, the Church of Satan, as well as obvious intelligence operatives, moving up into the Conspiracy Incorporated milieu is, in one sense, grotesque and also, I think, perhaps to be expected and past a point a bit on the amusing side. However, of the Council on Foreign Relations and its relationship not only to the intelligence community and but the media as well, Daniel Brandt writes as follows. Again, I'm reading from the Namebase Newsline newsletter of April through June of 1997. It's number 17. This is an article entitled Journalists at Work, Who's Watching the Watchdogs? And it reads as follows. In the handful of self-critical articles about the media that appeared 20 years ago, the matter of CIA connections with executives, editors, and reporters was emphasized. While this makes for good copy, and is certainly worth repeating, it also fails to challenge American journalism at its weakest point, the corrupting influence of fame and fortune. Someone who has looked at this issue recently is James Fallows, formerly of Atlantic Monthly. Fallows argues in his recent book, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy, that his profession is becoming seriously compromised. Boy, is he understating the case, although I know how he feels. The name recognition that comes from flaccid punditry can be lucrative on the lecture circuit. Or, if you have a name already, perhaps by doing something useless or naughty at the White House, you can acquire pundit status by writing a kiss-and-tell book. Big stars such as Cokie Roberts can collect five figures simply by offering up flattering platitudes at a corporate convention. Another problem is the revolving door between the media and the government. It's considered a badge of honor for a journalist to have spent time working for the White House, whereas it should be seen as a conflict of interest. Some suggest that it's okay to make the switch once. Bill Moyers can call himself a journalist after working for Lyndon Johnson, but David Gergen has been spinning through the door so often that it makes the rest of us dizzy. Gergen flacked for Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and finally Clinton, and between administrations, he was an editor at U.S. News and World Report and a commentator for PBS. Come to think of it, James Fallows himself, the new editor at U.S. News and World Report, was the chief speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. Pundits and superstars aside, the larger problem is that the media is owned by the ruling class. With the increased media centralization of the last 20 years, their lock on the masses is now so complete that when they maintain an appearance of objectivity, it's only out of habit. Sentences containing the words ruling class are scribbled self-consciously these days, a measure of how well they have cornered the market on perception and perverted what class consciousness we once had into a mass consumer consciousness. How can one distinguish between news and propaganda when the overlaps and interlocks are so pervasive? John Chancellor was with NBC, then with Voice of America, and then again with NBC. John Scali was with ABC, and then with Nixon, and then again with ABC. Ben Bradley of Watergate and Washington Post fame was once a propagandist in Paris, taking orders from the CIA station chief, and was friends with James Angleton. By the way, interrupting, James Angleton was the CIA's director of counterintelligence for many years. Continuing, Bradley's sister-in-law was Mary Meyer, divorced from Cord Meyer. She was JFK's lover, and her 1964 murder was never solved. Robert John Myers was in the CIA for 20 years, at one time was an assistant to William Colby, and became publisher of the New Republic in 1968. Generoso Paul Pope Jr. was in the CIA the year before he bought the National Enquirer in 1952. By the way, I would add that Generoso Pope was a CIA psychological warfare specialist. Continuing, Laughlin Phillips, co-founder of the Washingtonian, was in the CIA for 15 years. Former top CIA officials Cord Meyer Jr. and Tom Braden became columnists. Unlike Braden, Meyer rarely talks about his CIA career. George R. Packard and L. Bruce Van Voorst were with the CIA before they joined Newsweek, and Philip Guylen worked for the CIA while on leave from the Wall Street Journal. There's always Katharine Graham, one of the world's richest women, who is now recognized as a victim of the male-dominated culture because her new autobiography says it's so. In a 1988 speech at CIA headquarters, Graham warned to her audience, quote, We live in a dirty and dangerous world. There are some things the general public does not need to know and shouldn't. I believe democracy flourishes when the government can take legitimate steps to keep its secrets and when the press can decide whether to print what it knows. Here is a list of some pundits, news anchors, columnists, commentators, reporters, editors, executives, owners, and publishers. This list was compiled much too quickly, merely by scanning the 1995 membership roster of the Council on Foreign Relations, the same CFR that issued a report in early 1996 bemoaning the constraints on our poor, beleaguered CIA. It's not a wallet-sized card, but keep it handy somehow. The next time someone denounces all conspiracy theories as wacky, check out the name. You might not be surprised. By the way, first William Bundy and then William G. Hyland edited CFR's flagship journal Foreign Affairs between the years 1972 and 1992. Bundy was with the CIA from 1951 to 1961, and Hyland from 1954 to 1969. By the way, also note the book Catherine the Great by Deborah Davis. It's an excellent account of the Graham Publishing Empire's relationship with, among other things, the CIA. And, in fact, the CIA under Alan Dulles had much to do with the growth of the Graham Publishing Empire. And again, the title of the book, Catherine the Great, by Deborah Davis. Also note, too, with regard to the Inter-American Press Association, the first of Philip Agee's books, I slipped on the title in the first of these segments, it's called Inside the Company, a CIA Diary. He also had another book called Dirty Work as well. In fact, he may have even come out with a third book called Supplement to Dirty Work. In any event, Daniel Brandt presents a list of various journalists, mainstream journalists, who work for the CFR or part of the CFR, and it reads in many ways like a who's who of prominent American mainstream journalists, as well as some so-called alternative journalists. Rune Arledge, by the way, deeply involved with ABC Sports and later ABC News. Sidney Blumenthal, writes for the New York Times. David Brinkley, of course. Tom Brokaw. William F. Buckley. James E. Burke. Hiding Carter III, John Chancellor, George Crile III, Arno de Borgrave, Karen DeYoung, Christopher S. Dickey, Joan Didion, Leonard Downey Jr., Elizabeth Drew, Roland Evans Jr., James Fallows, Thomas L. Friedman, Suzanne Garment, Leslie H. Gelb, David R. Gergen, Philip L. Guilin, Georgie Ann Geyer, Catherine Graham, James L. Greenfield, Meg Greenfield, Peter Gross, Jim Hoagland, Juan Hoag, David Ignatius, Robert G. Kaiser, Marvin Kalb, Peter R. Kahn, Ann Karalekas, Joe Klein, Morton Kondracki, Charles Krauthammer, Irving Crystal, Jim Lehrer, Joseph Lelyveld, Lee Lescazi, Anthony Lewis, Flora Lewis, Michael Levitas, Michael E. Lind, Katie Martin, Jessica T. Matthews, Carl E. Meyer, Sig Mickelson, Judith Miller, Jack Nelson, John B. Oakes, Walter H. Pincus, Norman Podoritz, Dan Rather, Stephen S. Rosenfeld, A.M. Rosenthal, by the way, of the New York Times, Jack Rosenthal, Diane Sawyer, by the way, had worked for the Nixon White House, Daniel L. Shore, Robert B. Semple, Jr., Hedrick L. Smith, George Stephanopoulos, Strobe Talbot, Lawrence A. Tisch, Seymour Topping, Robert C. Toff, Mark Ulig, Garrick Utley, Katrina Vandenhuvel, L. Bruce Van Voorst, Milton V. Orst, Ben J. Wattenberg, Craig R. Whitney, Stephen Wiseman, Lally G. Weymouth, Roger W. Wilkins, and Mortimer B. Zuckerman. And again, this I've been reading from Namebase Newslines, issue of April through June of 1997. It is number 17. And courtesy, I want to tip a hat to a listener who sent this to me. I'm going to give the address, etc. I made an allusion to Spitfire. That's the tape duplication service that stocks all of my tapes at this point. They stock all of the half-hour segments that I've done, the various interviews, virtually all of the lecture tapes. They also now carry the weekly One Step Beyond shows, as well as the archive shows as well. You can contact Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. And again, that's one word, Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. There's also an email address for Spitfire, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. Once again, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. People can scan the updated webpage and get descriptions and links, etc., for the various archive shows, as well as now for all of the half-hour segments that I've produced and the interviews as well. You can access the Spitfire webpage as part of the KFJC webpage. KFJC-FM is the home base station on which I record these, at which I record these programs. It's located in the South San Francisco Bay Area. You can access the Spitfire webpage by contacting, or by pointing your web browser, rather, at www.kfjc.org. Once again, that's at www.kfjc.org, and look under Public Affairs and simply look for my name and that of Spitfire, and it'll be easy to get a hold of. So again, an updated webpage with something like 18 or 20 pages of descriptions of the newer broadcasts. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I receive no monies from present, recent, or future on-air endeavors. That concludes this broadcast. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.